You are listening to the Green Lantern Spotlight Podcast, Episode 3, Part 2, with our interview with Ron Mars for March 2009.
It's hell a thousand years ago, green fire, so hot. A carving and a man and a superman, and his name was Alan Scott. A man without fear, and that's for sure. He got his ring from Auckland Shore. He fought all the evil hordes, and he's the real one, Hal Jordan. Green Lantern! Green Lantern! Green Lantern!
All right, everyone. We are now joined by former Green Lantern writer, creator Kale Rayner, current Top Cow writer, the one, the only Ron Mars. Ron, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem.
And this is where we put in the CG, you know, the cheers and applause.
Like we said, fix it in post, make it sound like there's a studio audience.
Exactly.
Only the best. Only the best.
Yeah, we'll have the doctor from Family Guy saying, "How funny and chubby! I'm rooting for you." So, Ron, why don't you tell us a little bit how you got in the business and what brought you to Green Lantern back in the wonderful year of aught 94?
Well, geez, was it that long ago? I got into the business because Jim Starlin suggested that I should. That was basically how, you know, how the whole thing went down. He, you know, Jim and I had been friends for a number of years, lived in the same area, and, you know, Jim suggested that, I think the direct quote was, you know, it's a good way to put food on the table. I was actually working as a journalist, so, you know, it wasn't like I didn't have food on the table, but, you know, Jim suggested that, I try my hand at it, and he definitely showed me the ropes and took me into Marvel, you know, basically took me by the hand and, you know, deposited me on Marvel's doorstep, wrote my first few jobs with me, and then, you know, sort of threw me into the deep end of the pool. And, you know, then it was my job to sink or swim, and I've been doing it ever since.
Oh, wow. So what happened when they told you, come on over, and we want you to redo Green Lantern and make it a bestseller again, and we want you basically to get rid of the old Green Lantern and bring in a new?
Well, the whole thing was fairly unexpected, because I was doing mostly Marvel work at the time, and had just done, you know, I don't know, a handful of stories for Green Lantern Quarterly, you know, maybe three or four of them. And, you know, I had really enjoyed the stuff, but I didn't have any idea what was, you know, what was coming down the line. So, what actually happened is I was in, I believe it was a Friday night, and I was down at Marvel for the day with meetings with, you know, various and sundry editors for the books that I was working on there. And, I think I called an early day, caught the train home, got home, I don't know, 7 o'clock-ish or something like that, and my wife and I said, you know, the hell of it, let's go out for pizza and a couple of beers. We did that, and by the time I got home, there was a message from Kevin Dooley, who was the Green Lantern editor at DC, saying to please call him back, and so I did. Still wearing, you know, sweatpants and an honest to God Green Lantern T-shirt that I had gotten at a Warner Brothers store when they still had such things as Warner Brothers stores.
Right. Oh yeah.
Well, they closed those down when they started having, you know, Smallville underwear.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a law. If you have Smallville underwear, you have to close.
If not, it should be.
So, you know, so I called Kevin, and it had to be, you know, 9 o'clock at night or something like that. He was still at the office, and apparently so were Mike Carlin and Archie Goodwin and Denny O'Neill and Paul Levitz, and they were deciding the fate of Green Lantern. And, you know, they offered it up to me, and I thought, man, cool. You know, I can do a DC monthly book, and you know, and I get to write Hal and the Corps and everything, and then before my mind got too far down that road, you know, the other shoe dropped, and Kevin said, "This is what we want you to do," and then outlined the very, you know, the bare basics of what they had in mind for Emerald Twilight. And it wasn't really, you know, it was just, you know, the basics at that point were, you know, we're going to get rid of Hal. He's going to destroy the rest of the Corps and Oa, and we want to start fresh with a new Green Lantern. So, you know, I wasn't really prepared for that to kind of be laid on my doorstep. And I said, yeah, geez, it, you know, it sounds okay, but can I think about it a little while? And they said, sure. And the next day they faxed me because, you know, this was the, you know, the hoary days of, you know, 93 or 94 or whatever. I guess it was 94.
Yeah.
Early 94. You know, nobody was using email that much. So, you know, the fax machine spit out a page and a half of notes about, you know, where they were, what they wanted to do with the book. And that was essentially the outline for Emerald Twilight. It was, you know, the outline for issues 48 through 50. And it didn't have a whole lot of detail. You know, it was, like I said, it was literally a page and a half of story beats, and all the details were up to me. And then the last line of the outline, which I suspect I probably have somewhere, you know, scrolled away in a filing cabinet somewhere. The last line of the outline was, and then we introduce a new Green Lantern. And that was it. I mean, that there wasn't any direction in terms of who the new Green Lantern was or what he or she was supposed to be. It was completely wide open. And I actually had to, I probably, you know, stalled them for at least a week and a half maybe, before I finally said, yeah, I'll do this, because I knew it was obviously going to be a fairly big deal story in terms of taking out the, you know, the iconic main character and this sort of making it up from scratch. Obviously now I'm really glad that I took the gig, because I had a hell of a lot of fun doing it. But at the time, once I agreed to do it, it was, you know, it was pedal to the metal, because there had previously been three issues started by Jerry Jones, and when DC decided that they were going to pull the plug on those issues, I believe they had already been solicited. So those issues, you know, those issues went into a drawer never to be seen again. And so literally from the moment I took the job, we were late.
Oh, wow.
That's why there are three different artists on issues 48, 49, and 50, because... Man. I had to write them all at the same time, and they all had to be drawn at the same time, because we pulled the issues that were going to come out, and you know, literally, so I had to write, you know, like the first scene of one issue, and then the first scene of the next issue, and then the first scene of the next issue, so that everything could be drawn at the same time, and we could catch back up on the schedule.
Wow, you're like probably like on like nine different screens on your computer at that rate.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
he was writing by hand.
It was certainly. I did. I wrote some of it by hand at a Peter Gabriel concert between
sets. Oh, wow.
And that's the God's honest truth. I mean, it was that, you know, it was that tight in terms of the deadline that, like, every spare minute that I had to be thinking about these three issues and how the, you know, how we were going to make the story come together.
Man, so you he was singing about red and white, you know, clam chowder, and you were there like, I'm on page three of issue two.
Yeah, it was really, it was somewhat nerve-wracking, although, you know, once you get used to that in comics, it's not completely out of the ordinary to be writing issues out of order.
Right.
And obviously, to me, the biggest deal issue was 50, because that's when the changeover was going to happen. And that was also, a double-sized issue. So we had to, I felt like we had to make sure that we nailed that one. And that one got done. I probably even finished issue 50 before I finished either of the other two, in terms of the script, because, you know, it was going to be on a longer deadline because of the extra pages.
Wow. So what went into...
So that was, you know... Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, and then what led to the creation of Kyle Rayner?
You know, I just made him up. That's kind of what it comes down to. You know, they didn't. I asked if it could be a woman, and they said no. We'd prefer it. We'd stick with a male character, and I said okay. And that was it. I mean, they didn't give me any particular kinds of, you know, characteristics or design or background or history or anything, which frankly would never happen now.
Right.
I mean, there's no way in hell that they would just, you know, hand something like that to the creative team and tell them to, you know, here, go make it up and we'll see what you come up with. Things are much more editorially controlled now.
Seems like,
you know, characters just don't, you don't, as a creator, you don't get to have that liberty with characters anymore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, basically, you know, I made up the guy that I wanted to make up, and I decided that he should be an artist because I thought that would lead to the most visual kind of stories we could do. I felt like, you know, we had him be a California kid because I wanted the connection with him seeing Hal flying over in issue 49, I think it was.
Yeah.
Or 48, maybe. No, I think it was 48. And beyond that, you know, everything, we just made it up. I decided that I wanted him to have, you know, Irish-American background just because that's a culture that I like. So... Kevin Dooley sent me a list of Irish surnames that he pulled from somewhere, and I picked Rayner just because I thought it sounded cool. And the first name came from Kyle Reese in the Terminator movie.
Oh, wow.
Just because I thought that sounded cool.
Cool.
And Kyle Rayner sounded cool together. And Daryl Banks came up with the costume. There are a number of variations. Probably, I probably had that squirreled away in the filing cabinet too. I mean, Daryl did a bunch of different designs, and we sort of took most of one, but then added on bits and pieces of another. Daryl also came up with the parallax design, and Daryl even came up with the parallax name because we didn't want to just say, you know, here's your new anti-hero antagonist, Hal, because that seems a little, you know. anticlimactic. And then Daryl came up with Parallax, and we thought that's perfect. And we were off to the races. I mean, I knew that the first three issues were going to sell because it was a big deal. It was, you know, it was going to get a lot of press, and people were going to be, you know, having a conniption over it one way or the other. So to me, that wasn't a terribly difficult aspect of it to figure out. I mean, okay, I had an outline for it, which didn't have a whole lot of detail, but, you know, had the story basics. Sales were going to take care of itself. To me, the big job was creating a character that was likable enough and interesting enough that the people who picked up the first, you know, three or four issues to kind of test the waters on this new book and this new concept, you know, to me, the job was to keep those readers. And to keep them coming back. So, to me, the biggest deal was to create Kyle as somebody that the readership wanted to learn about and come back for every month.
And I have to say, because 1994 is when I came back into comics after being out of them since 87, one of the first things I picked up was Green Lantern. I always loved it, and, you know, it was just as the story arc was going, I was like, well, what are they doing with Hal? But then when I saw Kyle and I was reading about Kyle, I was like, hey, I think he's kind of cool. I think I'll stick around and see where he goes. So you won me over for a guy who was out of books for 7 years.
You know, I think a lot of, at least this is what I get, you know, sort of anecdotal evidence from people that are, you know, like that I meet at a convention or a signing or whatever. I think because it was seen as a ground floor read, as, you know, as here's your chance to get into Green Lantern if you've never been into it before. I think a lot of people took the opportunity to check it out, and you know, that was kind of their gateway book for at least Green Lantern, and maybe in some cases even the, you know, the larger DC universe.
I know it was for me.
And to me, that's something that always made an impression on me, that you know, books need to be accessible. Books need to have a ground floor, you know, every so often, so that you can welcome new readers in. Because frankly, you know, the people that read, you know, the people that are reading comics now, that's great. We love every one of them, but we need more. And if you don't, as a creator, make sure that you are putting out the welcome mat for those people every so often, you know, the only thing that happens is sales go down. You know, sales go down, readership goes down, interest goes down. That's just the nature of things.
So what's it like now, looking, I know I don't want to age any of us, but I mean 15 years later and looking back at that, you're just like, wow, I did that, and Kyle's pretty important now.
You know, I guess I still feel very, I guess I feel an attachment to the character, because, you know, Darryl and I made him up from scratch, and I lived with him on a daily basis for, you know, 7, almost 8 years. So, it was a huge part of my life for, a good portion of my life. But ultimately, when you're doing work for hire, which is what the job is when you're, you know, working in a shared universe and, you know, doing superheroes for the big two, I mean, ultimately, it's not yours. You don't own it. It's ultimately, anything that you create is the company's property, and they will do with it as they see fit, regardless of, you know, of what your, you know, considerations might be. So, I mean, I feel attached to the character, but I also, I also approach it from the standpoint of, you can be attached, but you can't be too attached, because, you know, ultimately, it's not yours, and they're going to do with it what they want, which is fine, and you know that going into the process. So, you know, I guess I'm proud that we've created a character that's been able to last for 15 years now. That's, you know, that's kind of cool, and the fact that it was a character that brought people either into comics or into the DCU, and that people still have, you know, an affection for, is great, because it, you know, like I said, it was really just Darryl and I, you know, making shit up, basically. it was really a rewarding experience, because we got all the great stuff that goes with the Green Lantern franchise, you know, the backstory and the villains, and, you know, we sort of got to play with all of that stuff as we wanted, but we didn't get tied to, you know, 40 years of continuity baggage either.
Right.
So we kind of got the best of both worlds. We got all the good that comes from, you know, shared history and continuity, but we weren't shackled to it.
Well, I mean, that sounds about it. I mean, I've myself worked on my own creative stuff here in my hometown with that, and I mean, ultimately, you know, once I let it go, you know, I had my input I created, but at the same time, I let go of it, and, you know, it's up to the person afterwards to see what they're going to do with it.
Yeah, it is, you know, you know that you're going to hand it off at some point. Unlike doing, you know, creator-owned stuff, which I'm doing more of now, I mean, that you completely invest yourself in, because it is yours, and it you know that nobody else is going to do anything with that unless you ask them to. Unless, you know, and if you don't want anybody else playing with your toys, you don't have to have anybody else playing with your toys. So, like when Luke Ross and I do Samurai Heaven and Earth at Dark Horse, you know, it's exactly what we want it to be. And it's exactly the kind of book that we put out with no restrictions or interference. And that's, you know, that's great. That's sort of the pinnacle of what you can do in comics, to me, is because it's, you know, it's complete creativity. You can just completely make it up without anybody looking over your shoulder, you know, telling you to have Supergirl guest star in the book this month because your sales suck right now.
Vigilante, anyone?
How true.
Well, we got a few questions here for you, Ron. I'm only going to shorten mine to two. One of my favorite characters that came out of your run of Green Lantern was Effigy. I just love the fact that he was pretty much Kyle's little rival there. I mean, he made flame constructs. The controllers gave him his powers. What went into Effigy's creation?
You know, truthfully, when you're doing a book like Green Lantern, where the hero has a certain amount of omnipotence, you know, I mean, ultimately, you're dealing with a guy who has a ring that can do anything. So, you know, like a dude robbing a bank isn't really, you know, worth a six-issue arc. You're constantly trying to come up with antagonists that are worthy of your hero. So in Effigy, I really kind of set out to make him Kyle's Sinestro. And I didn't want to just, you know, have a dude with a yellow ring, because to me then he would be, you know, oh yeah, he's not quite Sinestro, but he's a whole lot like him. I wanted to have somebody that was in that spirit and that could, you know, be creating things out of thin air just like Kyle could, but I didn't want it just to be, you know, a guy with a yellow ring. So you said it, I didn't. I think what Judd did with Nero was fine, but I wanted to do something that was, again, another step removed from a dude with a ring. So I came up with Effigy. And that's actually one that Daryl didn't design. Dave Johnson is a buddy of mine. Dave Johnson of sort of half of Red Sun fame. And I asked Dave to actually do the visual for Effigy. And, you know, Dave did it, and, you know, it looks amazing. It's a really simple but perfect kind of costume. I just liked the character a lot, because he was basically Kyle with a screw loose.
With a big giant high five on the back with the fire.
Yeah, well, thanks to Dave.
Yeah, Dave, I still like that, though. When I saw that in his back, I was like, ooh, that's kind of cool. I like that. My other question is, at this time Kyle came in, we, you know, had the new Green Arrow, which was Connor Hawk. I mean, at this time it seemed like, you know, DC was kind of trying to go for younger heroes and everything. I don't know. I mean, we can go into a whole, you know, younger, hipper crowd. But, I mean, how did that feel, the fact that, you know, you had Kyle Rayner, brand new Green Lantern, young, and then you had Connor Hawk, brand new, younger, you know, Green Arrow, who was the son of the original Green Arrow?
To me it was fun to have them play off of each other, because they were both, you know, they were both new, they were both rookies at what they were doing. And, you know, Chuck Dixon, who was a buddy of mine, created Connor Hawk and was writing Green Arrow at the time, so it was very easy to have the two characters play off of each other. I think part of probably what came along with Green Arrow is that, you know, we pushed the, you know, the older, more iconic hero to the side and brought in a new one with Kyle. And it was successful, you know, sold a shitload of copies, and the book, you know, the book did real well. And for a big part of my run, the only book that outsold it at DC was Justice League. With, you know, occasional specials and stuff like that, which to me was kind of like a screwball kind of, you know, I'm like, you know, why the hell is Green Lantern now telling Superman and Batman? This, there's like some cosmic imbalance here, that this isn't right. But we had a good run in terms of the sales and in terms of the reception. So, you know, nothing create success like success. So obviously the next one, they went, oh, well, let's do it with Green Arrow. I'm sure there are people out there that for them, you know, Kyle was their Green Lantern, because that's when they started reading the book. And by the same token, Connor is the Green Arrow for them, because that's when they started reading the book. I don't, you know, I don't get into, you know, Hal versus Kyle or Ollie versus Connor or anything like that. I mean, all that stuff's just silly because, you know, they're all made-up people. Nobody gets their feelings hurt. But, you know, that was the way the pendulum swung back in the 90s. Now it's kind of, now it's obviously swinging back the other way, and we're getting, you know, all of the 60s heroes back again.
Hal Jordan, Barry Allen.
Yeah, Ollie will be back, and there are some other, you know, other heroes coming back that haven't come out on the stands yet. But you know, to me, that's just the nature of the beast in comics. It's a question of, you know, again, the comics are just cyclical. You know, they're you know, dark and gritty for 10 or 15 years. And then they swing back to bright and sunny. And then when people have had a belly full of bright and sunny, they swing back the other way. You know, that's the nature of superhero comics. Because they are cyclical stories. They're, you know, the Fantastic Four always fights Dr. Doom. You know, that's the nature of the beast. They're, for the most part, superhero comics don't really have a beginning, a middle, and an end. You just have a lot of middle. And what you really end up doing in superhero comics is trying to convince the readership of the illusion of change. Yes. Because there's no real change in comics. I mean, if anybody listening to this thinks Bruce Wayne's not coming back as Batman at some point in the future, you know, I got a bridge in Brooklyn and swampland in Florida to sell you. But that's, you know, but you know, that's how it works. That's, you know, everybody gets their panties in a twist because Batman is dead, Bruce Wayne is dead, and somebody else is going to be Batman. Well, you know, if you've been doing this a while, you know that they've already done it like 6 times.
Right.
But it works and it's not every time, you know? You know, Marvel announces, oh, Spider-Man's going to change his costume, and everybody flips their lid. And, you know, I guess, again, it's the cyclical nature, because you're preaching to a new audience that hasn't seen this before. Everybody goes batshit, and then eventually, well, Spider-Man puts his old costume back on, and everything's back the way it was.
Right.
I mean, that's the way these books work, because they don't really break any new or different ground within reason, because they're corporate icons, and to a certain extent, you can't do much of anything with them.
Oh, I'll see. I'll turn it over to Ray because he's the big Rainer fan.
That I am. But I don't really have that much, you know, important questions. I'm just glad I'm here right now.
just gaping in awe. It's like,
I know, right? God,
Mars is here.
I don't know what to say. Anyway, aside from that, I'm not really worthy. You know, it's great to talk to you. I wanted to say the one issue that really, you know, that started me reading Green Lantern, and it's one that you were bringing up, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, was the Green Lantern, Green Arrow book that you started, the first, the Hard Traveling Heroes, the Next Generation book. That's what got me started. I started reading comic books again. And
oh, cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's the one issue I saw, like, sitting in an old, what do you say, like an old little deli. Someone just had it in their rack stand. I went, you know what, let me pick something up. And it was the only issue that, you know, got me interested just because it was, it had two characters that had no idea who they were. Had no idea. Only had vague inclination who the hell Green Lantern was during the old, you know, Super Friends cartoons. I decided to pick it up on a whim. And your book was the one that got me started reading it. So, thank you for that.
Cool. Well, it's, you know, I'm glad to know that we got, you know, the hook in your mouth, and here you are. We still got you.
I know, right? You have delicious bait.
Many thousands of dollars later.
And I guess the only questions I have would be, like, you know, what do you ever intend with Kyle's dad?
Oh, yes.
Well, you know, what I intended and what eventually
happened,
you know, was done were two different things, which, again, is that's just, you know, that's the nature of the beast. I mean, you know, I wanted to have I wanted Kyle's dad to be ultimately not in the picture. I wasn't I wasn't ever going to bring him into the storyline, just because I felt like so many characters, because you're dealing with, you know, DC icons that all date back to the 60s or earlier for the most part, all of them come from fairly normal two-parent, you know, Ozzie and Harriet families, because that's the era in which they were created. And I wanted to do, you know, single-parent guy, because I think that's the experience of a lot of people that were coming to the book. I mean, it wasn't my experience. I mean, my parents were married 50 years. But I know that simply reflecting that, you know, Ozzie and Harriet deal isn't really completely realistic. So I just wanted to do something different. And I wanted to have Kyle's father be, you know, out of the picture, dead somewhere. But it didn't turn out that way. Apparently he was hiding in Mexico. You know, again, that seems a curious choice to me for a guy that never was Latino in any way, shape, or form.
He was a
Spaniard. He had black hair. That makes him Latino, right?
Yeah, that's where it's fun, that Latino whole heat. Kyle Rayner's like half Mexican or something.
It's kind of weird.
You know, because you really do find so many green-eyed Latino people.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, he was half Latino, half Irish. It makes sense, kind of.
No, but again, it, you know, those are choices that other creators make, and that's the nature of these characters. I mean, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure John Bloom wasn't real happy when we found out that you know, Hal could have a breakdown like everybody else, and you know, kind of turn to the dark. So, you know, I'm certainly not one to sit here and throw stones about, you know, Kyle's father secretly being Mexican or whatever. That's in the scheme of things, it's not that big a deal.
Anything left there, Ray?
No, pretty much. That's pretty much all I want to know.
All right. Well, since he's down under and it's nice and bright in the morning, how about Kuhan? You can go next.
I don't have any questions from myself, but I went on a different forum and asked people. This is the iFanboy forum.
Oh, yes.
So, and I asked them, hey, do you have any questions for Mr. Ron Mars? And they've got... It's from the member O. Caroline. Question is, do you have a take on the women in refrigerator controversy, and would you do anything differently with the story if you wrote it today?
Is O. Caroline a Cheap Trick reference?
It's also a song by Sheryl Crow.
Now, I see, I'm old enough to understand that O. Caroline is a Cheap Trick reference. I don't know if you guys are.
It sounded familiar, but yeah.
I actually in my
know, I was born when you started writing Green Lantern, so
in
he's out of the loop.
So to you, Cheap Trick is essentially like, you know, like Beethoven. You know, it's so far in the past it's not even worth discussing. Actually, when I was a journalist, I interviewed Robin Zander, who's the lead singer in Cheap Trick. And
oh, really?
He was actually kind of a dick to me. So I don't know how that actually connects anything, but
him.
But he never created any comics. I shouldn't say that. I think they're actually a really good man. But anyway,
it's all good. The
refrigerator scene was a lot more explicit when it was initially drawn, because I mean, I came up with the idea that he would come home and find his girlfriend dead in the refrigerator, because Alex was destined to die from the moment that we created her, because I wanted to have the serious aspect of what Kyle was embarking upon come and slap him in the face. You know, it's because to me initially, when, you know, basically you it's like winning the lottery. You get a magic ring and you can do anything with it. How is this bad? How is this a responsibility? You know, where, you know, he's been given great power. Where's the great responsibility? He can do whatever the hell he wants. So I knew that, you know, the people around him, which is obviously a trope of you know, essentially all superhero comics, the people around him were going to pay the price for him being the hero. So Alex was, you know, Alex was toast from the minute we introduced her. I actually, the inspiration for the refrigerator scene came from the Stephen King novel Firestarter.
Oh, yes.
Which government troops come to the home of the main character, who's a kid, who's unfortunately was Drew Barrymore in the movie.
E.T. didn't phone home there.
Yeah. And I believe it was the character's mother who gets killed and stuffed in a washing machine. And to me, when I read the book, it made a huge impression on me, just like, oh shit, you know, these are really bad guys. So I wanted to have much the same kind of thing with Kyle. So when it was initially drawn, Daryl drew it so that the refrigerator door was open and you could see her body stuffed in there upside down. And we turned the book into the Comics Code, which was still, all the books still went through the Comics Code at that point. And, you know, I guess these were, you know, three or four blue-haired old ladies, and they had a conniption. I said, oh my, you know, you can't show that in a comic. That's, in a code-approved comic, that's horrific, and you can't do that. So they made us change it. They made us, but they didn't make us change it like you can't stuff a body in the refrigerator. They made us close the door 75% of the way. So it's actually the redrawn page that was ultimately used so that you can only see a little bit of her body in the refrigerator. The net result of that was that half the people that got the issue figured her body was cut up in there into different pieces. So, you know, thanks to the comics code stepping in and censoring us, everybody got a much more horrific depiction of in their head of what had actually happened. So,
wow.
You know, would I change anything? Of course not. Wow. I mean, you know, the example, and I've had this discussion any number of times, like, oh, that's, you know, that's a horrible thing. How could you write that? What's wrong with you? Don't, you must hate women. You know, you're a misogynist.
Gail Simone.
Just asinine.
Say what?
Right.
Probably mostly from Gail Simone.
I know Gail. That's actually how I met Gail in the first place, is she contacted me for a comment on that. And, you know, look, bad guys do bad things. You know, it's not like the hero did that.
Stop the presses.
It's not like it was behavior that we were telling the audience they should emulate. You know, we wanted to portray the villain in the story, Major Force, as a sadistic evil fuck.
Yes.
So we had him do something sadistic and evil. You know, gee, I'm sorry, but, you know, bad guys do bad things. But the example I always go back to is Hannibal Lecter. And, you know, when Thomas Harris writes a Lecter novel, he's not really coming out in favor of cannibalism. You know, it's not like this is behavior that he's saying, hey, isn't this great? Everybody should just. That's not the point. The point is he's a really bad guy and he does bad things to people.
It's something that people can't get their heads around.
Right.
The point was much the same here. You know, I wanted Alex's death to make an impression on people and not be the typical, you know, sort of comic book fatality. So the fact that we're talking about it 15 years later probably means we were successful at what we wanted to do.
Right. Well, see ya, Kuhan.
Okay, and this is from member Neb. Which is Ben backwards.
Probably not named after a Cheap Trick song.
I confirm that.
It's what do you think about Kyle's being treated today, and if you could pick up the character again, what would you change or what would you do with him?
You know, I'm fine with what's going on with Kyle today. Again, it's, you know, you to some extent it's like, you know, you raise your children for for a while, and then you send them off into the world and hope that the world treats them well. And I think Peter Tomasi is doing a really nice job, and Jeff has always gotten the character and done a really nice job with it, with him. So I'm perfectly fine with what they're doing. To me, it's interesting to see Kyle interact with the rest of the Green Lantern Corps, because that's something that I never really got a chance to do. If I had stayed on the book longer, that was where things were starting to point. In a couple of years, that's what I wanted to eventually bring back at least some aspect of the Corps. I don't think we would have had 7,200 members. We probably would have had a few dozen. But I thought it had been enough that we could start bringing some of those elements back in, and my intention was to have John Stewart be essentially a guardian along with Gambit. But obviously, I ended up leaving the book and taking an exclusive with CrossGen before we ever got to bring that stuff to fruition. So, like I said, it's kind of cool for me to now see that stuff going on.
Are you still a reader?
Off and on. I'm on DC's comp list, so I get all the books anyway.
Nice. There
you go.
But I don't have, anywhere near the time to check them all out. So usually what I do is I'll have to stack up and build up. And then when I get a chance, I sit down and go through a bunch of them. But I'm lagging pretty far behind in my reading right now.
I'm with you there.
When my Top Cow editor calls, he doesn't hear that. Well, what did you do today? Oh, DC Comics, that's great.
What, Green Lantern, what? What's the next question, Kuan?
Okay, what else I've got? Okay, so now I've got some non-Green Lantern questions, but might as well. From the member Cam, with an exclamation point, all caps and exclamation mark, how was Sojourn supposed to end?
Well, it wouldn't have actually ended. It would have just kept going. But by issue 50, we would have killed off Beth, who was the big undead bad guy. But Arwen wasn't the one to do it. It would have actually been the troll captain Boar,
wow,
who would have eventually figured out a way to kill off his master. So Arwen's whole quest would have turned out to be sort of unfulfilled and kind of a boondoggle, because bringing the pieces of the arrow actually worked, because by that point, all of the powerful beings that were in the CrossGen universe would be destroyed in the never-to-be-completed Negation War. So ultimately what she was trying to do wouldn't have worked, and they would have had to find another way to kill off the big bad guy. And then my intention after that was that the book would continue, but R wouldn't be a main character anymore. She'd sort of go off into the wilderness to be by herself, and we would see her once in a while, but not on a regular basis. We'd bring in a new cast. But, best laid plans and all that.
What do you got left there, Kuhan?
Okay, and I got the last question, which is from the actual host of iFanboy, Josh Flanagan. It's not really a question as much as a statement about how the refrigerator, about Witchblade, how it's, she was a cheesecake model, and how the between that and the refrigerator.
I'm sorry, what is it?
Yeah, you have to repeat that. We lost you there. Come on.
I don't know how that happened. Witchblade is, he says, Witchblade isn't, this is a direct quote, Witchblade isn't exactly a symbol of progressive feminism. She was a cheesecake model for fanboys for a long time, at least that was the wide perception. It's an interesting contrast for the guy who's credited with starting the refrigerator thing.
So, what's his point?
He said, actually, at this point, I usually just move the microphone to the creator's face and hope they say something.
Well, I guess he's trying to be provocative, but really all he ends up doing is looking stupid, because, frankly, I've been writing Witchblade for almost 5 years now, and it hasn't been that sort of book since I took it over.
Right. No, and that was the odd perception. He says it's fantastic.
Well, I can't help what I can't help the perception that people have had from issues that I didn't write. I can only worry about the stuff that I did write.
Right.
And to me, you know, frankly, Witchblade, you know, Sarah Pazzini runs around wearing a hell of a lot more clothes than Wonder Woman or Power Girl or She-Hulk or, frankly, any Marvel or DC superheroine you want to name. when I took over Witchblade, I told them, when they asked me to take over Witchblade, I said, look, guys, if you want stories that are excuses for her clothes to fall off, that's great. Knock yourselves out. Don't hire me to do it, because I won't. I said, if you want me to give this a try, and we'll do stories about her as a detective and her dealing with this, you know, supernatural artifact that she has, you know, let's do it. Let's try out a story that actually brings people back because they care about the character, not because they care about the state of undress that the main character is in. And to Top Cow's credit, they said, you know, do what you want. And that's the way it's been ever since day one. They haven't given me any, you know, could she be a little more, you know, sexy in this issue? Or, you know, we haven't shifted from doing sexy stuff when it's part of the story, but, you know, it's actually sexy stuff that involves Sarah and her boyfriend, you know, having sex, as people do.
Right.
You know, the whole metal bikini stuff with Witchblade just never made sense to me, because if you were going to, you know, like, fight a slobbering demon from hell, wouldn't you want, like, a suit of armor rather than a bikini? So that's the direction that we've taken the book, and I gotta say, I'm having a ball doing it, you know, even 4 years later. To me, it's a book that's a lot more grounded in reality than, you know, the superhero connected universe stuff, because we can do a lot more, you know, character-driven stories. So, I don't really understand what his point is. We killed a woman in Green Lantern, and we didn't kill a woman in Witchblade. I don't know what the whole direction is. But, sometimes writers make choices for, you know, bad things to happen to good people in stories. And sometimes we make choices for the woman to be a kick-ass heroine like Sarah is in Witchblade.
Nice. Well,
I think you actually just answered his question to the best that you could have.
Right.
Sorry, say it again?
I think you answered his question, you know, marvelously. I think it was a great, the way you answered that question.
You get the Green Lantern applause for that one.
I think the question was a bit of a jab at you, but I do get that the Witchblade kind of does stem from the whole bad girl of Revengelines and your Lady Death and all that other stuff that was going on at the same time. But I know that it's moving.
Well,
on
sure, but instance. You know, Batman used to fight space aliens on a regular basis.
Yeah, yeah.
With a smile on his face. So, you know, so again, you know, comics are cyclical, and the stories we end up telling reflect not only the way that the creators approach those stories, but also the eras in which those stories are created. So, if you want to look at a Witchblade book from 10 years ago, it's going to be appreciably different than it is now. And I assume if you look at a Witchblade book 10 years from now, and I'm not writing it at that point, it'll be appreciably different from what it is now. It's just the natural way that things evolve.
All right.
That's all I got.
Yeah. All right. Well, then we'll move over to Wes, and then we'll get to Andrew's laundry list here.
That's not that bad.
Well, Wes has got his ironing list, right?
Well, I don't have any questions. I just wanted to ask you about CrossGen. When it was all said and done, did you ever look back and regret, like, going over there and starting that up?
No, not at all. I think, I regret the way it ended, certainly, because it didn't have to end like that. It frankly didn't have to end at all, but it was just sort of the stupidity and the obstinance for of the management of Mark Alessi mostly, that, you know, kind of led us down the primrose path of destruction, which is, you know, which is unfortunate, and a lot of people got dinged pretty bad in terms of the finances for it. So, yeah, obviously everybody wishes that didn't happen, but the experience itself was great, and I think most everybody that was there would tell you the same thing. Beginning of the month, I was in Orlando for MegaCon, and chiefly I went down to hang out with all my old cross-gen buddies, like Brandon Peterson and Greg Land and Jim Chung, Mike Perkins. You know, a lot of those guys are still in Florida, and, you know, so to go back there was kind of a reunion, and a lot of those guys, you know, are still my really good friends. It was, in terms of the working situation, it was great because it was really collaborative, and you got to work literally side by side with the other guys that were doing the book with you, which never happens in comics. I mean, obviously, most of the time in comics, you know, a writer is one place, the pencilers across the country, the inkers in another, you know, the inkers in a different state, the colorist might be in Europe somewhere. I mean, everybody's scattered far and wide, but at CrossGen, you know, we were literally in the same studio together. So to be able to work like that in a collaborative way was tremendous. I know all the guys that I worked with really enjoyed that part of it because you really got to, you know, to bounce ideas off of each other, and everybody's work improved because of that creative environment. And we all got to take creative ownership of the books too. We got to make the books ours in terms of how they looked and how they read, and we were essentially our own editors. We were the last ones to look at the book before it went off to press. You know, we would proof our own books, and we could fix things right up to the last minute, and everybody would pitch in and make sure that the book was as good as it could possibly be. It wasn't the assembly line process that comics are for the most part at every other place. There was a lot of care that went into each issue because we were all there and we all had each other's backs, but there was also a sense of competition that everybody wanted their book to be better than the next guy's. So, you know, that aspect of it was tremendous, and I don't regret the experience at all because of all that stuff. It was a pain in the ass to, you know, eventually leave the company and, you know, sort of go back to writing freelance and, you know, rebuild your career, and we eventually moved from Florida back to the East Coast. All of that was a pain in the ass. But, you know, it was a pretty cool, I think we were down there for a total of 5 years. You know, we stayed around for some time after the company, well, I left, I don't know, 6 months before the company actually blew apart and was closed. But, you know, we still have friends down there that we go down and visit, and I'm still in touch with all the guys that that I worked with. It was pretty cool. It was a noble failure. That like I said, didn't have to fail. There was just, you know, it was too much too soon. You know, at its height, we were publishing, I don't know, 18 to 20 to 22 books a month when we should have been publishing 8 at the most. And that was something that we tried to make real obvious to the guy in charge that, you know, if we're making X amount of money publishing 4 books, you don't make 2X publishing 8 books. That's not the way the math worked. That you eventually would just end up eating into your own readership and eating into your own profits. Right. So while your overhead kept going up, your readership stayed relatively level. Ultimately, that's a recipe for failure, and that's exactly what happened. So, you know, I look back with regret, but I also look back with, you know, a lot of fondness about what happened. I mean, there were you know, insanely crazy shit happened there. And, you know, we've all got anecdotes about a lot of it. So, yeah, there was some, you know, there was some nutty stuff that went down that I don't think anybody will ever forget. No, I'm not going to tell you those stories because I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but,
right.
you know, I'm glad I did it. I mean, at the point in my life where we were, it was just my wife and I, and our son was about to go into kindergarten, and we said, you know what, let's try this out and see what happens. And if the whole falls apart, we'll have lived by the beach for a few years and we can come back home. That's exactly what happened. You know, for the most part, it was a lot of fun.
Crossstone was a lot of fun back in the day, I remember.
Yeah, it definitely was.
I was there for the beginning of it.
See, you're the reason we went out of business. You stopped buying the books.
No, I stayed with it. My brother and I stayed up with it till the end.
Well, I'm sorry to say, I was a death of you.
Yeah, his first name's Rainer. Anyhow. Okay, Andrew, I know you've been waiting patiently, so pull out the list and we'll get out of your way.
All right, Ron, I just want to first say that, you know, you are the man that brought me into Green Lantern and largely into comics in a big way. Huge Kyle fan, just a big fan of yours. I think we've exchanged a bit of Q&A on the comic block quite a few times. And getting to the first question here, and this is something we kind of touched on recently, actually. Going back to the Ion Maxi series, you said that it was presented to you as an ongoing series, and then it was changed to a Maxi series, and then it was changed midway to be a setup for the Sinestro Corps War. You said that the decisions behind this weren't because of sales at all, but were because of creative needs. Can you talk at all about this?
Well, you know, welcome to comics.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the way it works sometimes. You know, like I said, when it was initially presented to me, it was going to be an ongoing. And so that's how things were predicated. That's what, that's how I designed the background for the book and moving him to a new location and giving him a new supporting cast and all that. By the time we got into the second issue, or at least the writing of the second issue, word came down that, you know what, we've got too many ongoings started with this 1 year later. We're gonna do this as a 12 issue maxi. Because they were starting things like Adam and Blue Beetle and I can't remember, you know, everything else that came out at about that period. But they didn't want to have too many ongoings because they wanted publishing slots open later, you know, a year later.
Other things coming down the pike.
Yeah, so we eventually, and I'm sure there are probably reasons for that I'm not privy to, probably both financial and creative. So what we had thought was initially going to be an ongoing suddenly was more of a finite series, but we had already started partway down the path with issue 1 and 2, which, you know, 2 being written, 1 being drawn. So we made adjustments. We made adjustments to the storyline to bring it into more of a finite package. And then as we got about halfway through that finite package, Sinestro Corps started coming together, and there were needs to fulfill, to set up different elements of that storyline. So, you know, what started out as sort of being a standalone series that, with the intention of making, of separating Kyle out from the core and making him a unique hero in Ion, by the end of it, the job was to bring him back into the core for Sinestro Corps storyline, and he's not going to be Ion anymore. Again, that's kind of the nature of the beast. Sometimes you can just sit down and write your story and you don't get any editorial input or interference or kibitzing or anything like that. Sometimes the coin lands face up, sometimes it lands face down, and either way you just deal with it. It's, like I said, that's that goes along with the territory when you're in a shared universe. You're ultimately serving serving more masters than just your own story. You know, again, when I do creator-owned stuff, I don't have to worry about any of that stuff. I know I'm the captain of my own ship, and we're not going to, there isn't any going to be any anything different than what I expect. In this case, there was, but you know, but ultimately, it's set up, or you know, I don't mean to say it's set up because it didn't, but it played into what was a pretty cool and very successful storyline for DC in Sinestro Corps. So you know, it's in the end result, it's all good.
It just seems like he had just become Ion, and then they kind of give him a little jerk job with, oh, we're going to make him Parallax, we're going to make him a regular Green Lantern, and there's even talk about making him a Blue Lantern. It's just, it seems like the character is getting yanked around a little bit, and I just think that's a little bit unfortunate. But
well, it's,
as long as it's for the greater,
you know,
good.
I don't think I'm telling stories out of school to, you know, to say that things are much more fluid at DC these days than they were, you know, I don't know, 15 years ago when I created Kyle. You know, when I created Kyle, they just said, here, go do it. And, you know, trusted me to either pull it off or at least, you know, fall on my face in such a way that they could, you know, shove me to the side and fix it later. Nowadays, because everything is much more interrelated and, you know, the cycle of comics right now points to, you know, to big event storylines. You have less of a free hand, and you know, if the answer that you're initially given is blue, at some point the answer might change to red, and you just have to, you know, be accepting of that because
roll with the punches.
Yeah, I mean, you either roll with the punches or you go find something else to do. And in the case of Ion, initially the thinking, you know, the overall editorial thinking was, well, Kyle's going to be Ion, and then he's going to be Ion for good, and that's what his role is going to be. Somewhere along the line, that changed, and now there's a different Ion. So, you know, that's just how it shakes out sometimes, and you know, my biggest worry over the whole Ion thing in terms of those 12 issues is I didn't feel like we got the opportunity to tell a complete story. We didn't close the storyline off at the end so that after 12 issues of people's time and $36 of their money, they didn't really get a complete story. They got a story that pointed them off into another direction. And, you know, basically, here, buy more stories to find out what the ending of this one is.
Although I do like what you were able to do with the Sinestro Corps, or actually I think it's the Green Lantern Corps / Sinestro Corps Ion special. You kind of provided a good end cap to things, and not just the Ion, but almost your whole run on Green Lantern so far. If things had to end right there, I thought that was a good place to leave them.
Oh, well, fine. I mean, again, that was obviously a very collaborative process because in, you know, the special that I did for the Sinestro Corps storyline, you know, obviously this is Jeff's story, and I'm just, you know, it was Jeff's story. He was, you know, setting the direction and setting the tone, and I was just happy to play along. He was the conductor. I was just like, you know, the guy sitting in the third violin chair.
All right. About back to Ion a little bit, not so much on the gloom and doom, but with Marissa and Donna. I know you'd always kind of regretted what happened with Donna during Volume 3 of Green Lantern, how it got kind of yanked away from you. What were you planning there? Was there going to be like a love triangle? Was there going to be something with Marissa? Can you talk about that?
Well, ultimately what we wanted to do, or what I wanted to do in Ion, was to have Marissa be an earthly love interest for Kyle, and then to create a different outer space love interest for Kyle, so that we would get that, you know, you would get that triangle, but you would have the added aspect of, you know, one being out in space and one being on Earth, so that that sort of reflected the two directions in which Kyle was torn as a hero as well. Obviously, that didn't come to pass because, you know, other storylines took precedent. In some ways, and I didn't even make this connection at the time, but in some ways it's like, you know, it's like the old classic Lee and Kirby Thor stories where, you know, he's got Jane Foster on Earth and he's got Sif and Asgard and they're both, you know, he's pulled in both directions.
Interesting.
So that would have been, the, where that was headed. As far as Donna, you know, when she was yanked out of the book, because John Byrne doesn't play well with others, you know, I thought it was just, that was just an awkward, a very awkward ending to that relationship. And I felt like it wouldn't really serve either character to revisit that relationship because it ended, you know, because the ending was so awkward and abrupt that to revisit that relationship to any great extent, you would sort of have to revisit why it ended in the first place.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a good reason. You know, I couldn't put in the book that you know, John Byrne wanted to use her in Wonder Woman, so we had to break up.
Editor's note.
Yeah.
So, I always liked Donna's character a lot, and I liked them together. And I was, you know, one of the few DC books I read as a kid. I mean, one of the two DC books, frankly, that I read as a kid, was Titans. So, to be able to, you know, be writing Donna on a regular basis was really cool for me, because, you know, I was a big fan of that stuff, when I was a regular reader. So, you know, I don't even remember how long their relationship went on for, but I kind of liked the fact that it was, you know, he was kind of the junior partner in the relationship. She was older. She had been married. You know, she had been a hero a lot longer. So that, you know, sort of slightly older woman, you know, Mystique was there. That was kind of cool.
All right. Okay, Hal Jordan is Parallax. Now, I have the opinion, and I know it's kind of an unpopular one, at least in the fandoms I've been around, that turning Hal Jordan to a well-intentioned megavillain, basically DC's version of Magneto, was probably one of the best things to happen, not only to Hal as a character, but to DC. I just think that for once, Hal's character really had an arc to him, and DC had a kind of a supervillain he'd never seen before. So how do you look at it?
Well, I mean, that was the plan. That was certainly what the intention was. You know, I've said this before, that there was, if there was supposed to be a back door in the storyline for Hal to come back, if, you know, if Kyle turned into a, you know, spectacular failure, nobody ever told me about it, because it, you know, we didn't build that into the storyline at all. So the way that I approached it was that, you know, Hal was going to be Parallax. That was a long-term plan, and I didn't really see Hal as a villain in any way. I mean, I saw him very much in terms of a Marvel villain, like Magneto, like Doctor Doom, who are completely convinced of the righteousness of their cause. Yeah. You know, to me, all of the really good villains are, in their own minds, the heroes of their own stories.
Exactly.
You know, to me, that's always been the difference between a lot of the, in general, I mean, this isn't hard and fast by any means, but, you know,
they
Marvel villains
doing the right thing.
Yeah, Marvel villains want to do the right thing. Marvel villains want to conquer the world. You know, Doctor Doom, Magneto, Namor, they're interested in world domination. They want to remake the world in their own image to what they believe is a better place. DC villains generally rob banks.
Yeah.
You know, with elaborate lasers.
Yeah, you know, Magneto wants to, you know, wants to reshape the world for the betterment of mutant kind, and the Rainbow Raider is picking up extra cash for the weekend.
Well, Captain Coulson will pick up chicks.
I don't think that's the case anymore, because I think a lot of the DC villains have been amped up. But that was always sort of the conventional wisdom. So, you know, when we created Kyle, certainly my intention was to do a more Marvel-style character in the DC universe, to do sort of that hero with feet of clay in the DCU, which is much more about, you know, square-jawed, you know, righteous, convinced of their cause heroes, because they were created in a simpler time than the Marvel heroes.
Iconic is the buzzword nowadays.
Well, I think you can, iconic heroes, you can certainly have iconic heroes that are, that have sort of that, the feet of clay or the flaw of,
yeah.
of you know, a Spider-Man or the Hulk or, you know, Iron Man. They've all got some sort of flaw that humanizes them. I mean, to me, that humanizes those characters. And those, I grew up reading Marvel comics, so that was my background for reading comic book characters. I mean, to me, I like Spider-Man always appealed to me a lot more than say Superman, because I found Spider-Man more relatable, which, you know, is a very trite and kind of obvious thing to say. But that's just where, you know, what appealed to me. It doesn't make one better than another. It was just, that's what the appeal of the characters was to me. So when I got my chance to make up a DC hero, that's the mold that I strove for. And so the same thing happened with Parallax, is that, you know, we wanted him to be, I guess Magneto is the most obvious comparison, because what he was doing was wrong by virtually everybody's standards, but not in his mind, and to a certain amount of people, and certainly to a certain amount of the readership, what Hal was trying to do was not wrong.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting. So
the long-term plan was to really have him be this, you know, this sort of cosmic level antagonist who would only show up every 2 years or so, but, you know, he would show up and he would be, he would be, you know, not so much a villain, but definitely an opposing force, but he would also be this really tragic character, almost tragic on the Shakespearean level.
Then they Darth Vader'd him off a little bit too soon, I think.
Well, you know, again, because you're in a shared universe, not everything is in your control. And certainly not everything was even in my editor's control, because Final Night came along, because there were some people that were bent out of shape about what had happened to Hal and wanted to fix him, in their mind, wanted to, quote-unquote, fix him and make him not an antagonist, or in their mind, a villain, and, you know, make him go out a hero.
And I have to say, though, you did an excellent job with the Parallax special. I mean, I didn't like that he was getting written off so soon. I thought he had a lot of potential as Parallax, but gotta say, I was weeping like a little bitch at the end of that.
It was a well-written story. I really enjoyed it, too.
And I think...
Thanks. I really liked writing that. I mean, working with Mike McCone is, you know, it's easy to get amped up and excited for the material anyway. And, you know, to be able to do that kind of tragedy and know that you're dealing with a hero or antagonist or anti-hero, whatever you want to call him, who was going off to his death. I mean, you don't get to do that very often in comics, because nobody ever dies in comics. So that was a treat, even though I didn't agree with the fact that, you know, we had turned Hal into Parallax, and 2 years later, or whatever it was, we were going to toss him away by having him, you know, go into the sun. I just thought, well, that, you know, that's kind of stupid. If we were going to do that, why didn't we just kill him off in the first place?
Yeah,
right.
You know, to me, it was a waste of character opportunity. But again, you know, I think sometimes the fans kind of feel like, you know, the creators are completely on their own to just do what they want, you know, and that's most often not the case. You're really waiting for, in terms of character deaths and stuff like that, those decisions are made by editorial, and in this case, editorial made the decision that, you know, they were going to, you know, whack Hal in a big deal event.
Heroic sacrifice.
And then, you know, 6 months later, whatever it was, they decided that they were going to take a suggestion from some dude on a message board and bring Hal back as a Spectre.
Yeah. Oh, it was not me.
I'm not being facetious. I'm not being facetious. That's actually what happened. They actually, it was some sort of, you know, monetary exchange with the guy because they used his idea. And ultimately what that was is, you know, it was two properties that were not, you know, that were dormant at the time. The Spectre was dormant. Hal Jordan was dormant. So they figured, well, let's put them together and see if we can, you know, have something that'll, you know, turn a couple of bucks for the company. And it, I don't know, lasted 18 issues or something like that. To me, not the best idea, because I never understood why the Spectre was wearing a mask.
No.
You know, if you're the Spectre,
to make him look more Green Lantern-ish. Because he still had the Green Lantern logo on there too, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it was just looked a little funky to me, but
made so much sense.
I mean, we got some glorious Ryan Silk artwork out of it, so.
Oh, yes.
In the long run, I guess maybe it was pretty cool.
That's kind of a side comment here. I thought it was interesting earlier that you mentioned how John Broome might look ahead and say, "Oh Jesus, what's going on? Why is Hal, you know, going crazy and doing all this stuff and all these changes are happening?" I think it's almost a parallel between what people were saying about the New Gods and stuff recently. How Jack Kirby is probably rolling in his grave about all the changes to the New Gods and stuff like that, and how it should never change and be the same always. And I think that's kind of like the opposite of what these guys are all about. I mean, maybe they'd see this stuff and they'd be like, wow, this is exciting shit. I mean, what do you say?
I had heard that, I actually met John and, Gil Kane. I did a short story with Gil Kane, which was, you know, to me, just incredibly cool. Gil was always one of my favorites. I mean, even when I was a kid, I could tell when Gil Kane drew something, and I could tell when George Perez drew something, without looking at the credits. I mean, their styles were so distinctive. As a kid, I was like, you know, this is a specific person, and I really like what he does. So I had heard that John, who had been out of comics for years and years and was actually living in Japan, was not real, you know, was kind of baffled as to what the hell happened to Hal. So, you know, I'm not at all, you know, I'm not one to sit here and say, well, you know, tough shit, it's not your character, it's DC's, they can do what they want. You know, when I heard that you know, that John Broome, who was this really, you know, elegant, elderly gentleman, you know, was not real happy, you know, I didn't like it. I didn't like the fact that I had done something that he wasn't pleased about. But yet I, you know, I can't, you know, base my decisions on someone I've never met either. I can only do what I think is, you know, is best for me and best for my work.
All right. On a different note, I read a story a while back. Jeff Johns mentioned before that, well, before he was Jeff Johns, he'd meet with you in conventions and such, and you were always very kind and encouraging to him. Do you have any memories of the young Jeff Johns that you can share?
Yeah, I mean, I met Jeff. I'm sure the first time I met him was probably up at the DC offices. Just, you know, really nice. I mean, Jeff is the same guy then as he is now. He's a nice, genuine guy, and he's incredibly enthusiastic about comics. And, you know, what he does comes from a place of, you know, unadulterated love for the medium and for the characters. You know, I've seen where, you know, Jeff said I went out of my way to be, you know, to be nice to him, where some other pros were maybe dismissive or something like that. And I, you know, I really didn't go out of my way to be nice to Jeff. I just try to be nice to everybody that I come into contact with, because, you know, why wouldn't you? You know, Jeff's a good guy. I enjoy hanging out with him. I really enjoyed the first stuff that he broke in doing, especially Stars and Stripes. I just thought was a treat. I love that book. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I do a lot of work with Lee Motor now, is that I, you know, really dug Lee's stuff on that. And I'm really, you know, pleased as can be to, you know, to have Jeff having all this success and really, in a large way, kind of setting the tone for for where the DCU goes. I think there are some writers who are Marvel writers. There are some writers who are DC writers. There are some writers that you can't pigeonhole to one company or another. To me, Jeff is definitely a DC writer. He loves the characters. He knows the characters. And I think what he does, touches upon and augments the things that are really the best about DC as a whole. He's a good guy, and I'm really pleased anytime I get to see him.
I know you said that you don't have any stories left in the drawer at DC that are Green Lantern related, but can you say anything about the ones that aren't?
There are always stories, and there's stuff that you want to get. I mean, hell, I've got stories that are in inventory drawers up there that still haven't seen the light of day. So maybe someday my Batman and Solomon Grundy story will actually see print. But
I'll pick it up.
At this point, it's one of those things that, I mean, literally it's been in a drawer for 10 years, so it might see the light of day, maybe it won't. But I've got certain stories that I would like to tell at some point, but right now the majority of my time is spent with Top Cow, because they treat me well, they pay me well, they let me do what I want for the most part. There aren't a lot of restrictions or editorial fingers in my pie. So it's a really good gig, and that's what takes up the majority of my time. And the stuff that isn't taken up by them is creator owned stuff, either there or at Dark Horse. Certainly, if something comes up and I've got a chance to work it into my schedule at DC, I would certainly try to squeeze it in, because I like the characters and I like a lot of the people that work up there. DC was kind of my family for a long time, until we went to Florida for CrossGen. So I still have, I still have friends up there, and I still have ships up there that are important to me.
Speaking of that, do you have any ideas in the back of your head? And you don't need to get into them, but any ideas in the back of your head, like if they came to you tomorrow and said, hey, Ron, well, obviously after the Top Cow exclusivity runs out, they came up to you tomorrow and said, hey, Ron, would you write a Kyle special for us? Do you have something in the back of your head that you can pull out?
Not really. I don't have anything, essentially off the top of my head that is appropriate, just because, every time you pick up a character, the character is in a different place than it was the last time.
Yeah.
That's the nature of the shared universe. So, they hardly ever come to you and just say, hey, you got a story. They usually come to you and say, hey, we need a story about this, and the character does this thing. So you usually have parameters that come with the gig.
They give you the premise.
Yeah, I mean, it's or not even the premise, or just, here's what we need. With the Sinestro Corps one-shots, obviously those were part of a larger storyline, so we had certain beats that we needed to hit in each one of them. When you get to just create from scratch, that's great, and there are some of those types of stories squirreled away in my files. Maybe we'll get around to them at some point. But, there's certainly stuff that we talked about when I was on the book that we never got to. I don't even know if any of it would even be appropriate, and not just for Green Lantern, but for other characters too. We'll see. I have the nice aspect of my work is that I never get up in the morning and wonder what I'm going to do. I've always got something in front of me to do. So, if there's an opening in my schedule down the road a little bit, I'd love to, because I started out in Marvel, and I was a Marvel reader as a kid growing up, but DC always felt more like home to me.
Cool. Now, you've been talking about how comics should always be, at least at certain points, accessible to new readers to bring them in. Now, what would you say about how today's comics are kind of they're not really appealing to new readers. They're kind of, it's kind of become more of a collector's industry. Like, we're seeing the comic stores go away. Comics aren't in grocery stores anymore. And there's, I don't really see a lot of hooks for, like, the young kids like there used to be. Do you see that changing, or do you see that becoming...
Christ, I hope it changes, or, you know, in 10 years I'm going to be looking for, you know, I'll be pumping gas. I think we, as an industry, do kind of a shitty job of welcoming people into the industry in terms of making it accessible for readers. And a big part of it is that we publish too goddamn many superhero books. You know, that's 90% of the direct market, or 90, probably closer to 95 or 96% of the direct market is superhero comics. And that's what the direct market audience wants. It's unfortunately not what 95% of the reading public wants, because to a great extent, and I know this is hard for, like, hardcore superhero fans to actually wrap their minds around, to a great extent, the general public doesn't give a shit about superhero comics.
Yeah.
They're still seen as kind of adolescent crap. And even though the stories themselves aren't, that's the perception. And if that's the perception, you're not going to get people over that barrier by just publishing more superhero comics.
Yeah.
And I think we as an industry need to have more diversity. We need to have different kinds of stories that are of interest to, you know, more than the every Wednesday crowd that, you know, that show up every Wednesday like, you know, heroin addicts for their hit.
Lemmings.
And by all means, you know, thank God for them, because they're, you know, the every Wednesday crowd is, you know, is essentially paying my mortgage. But, you know, we need to, if comics are ever going to get out of the ghetto that they're in, we need to do more stuff, you know, frankly, like Bone or like Watchmen, that's a superhero book, but it's a lot more than a superhero book. We need to do more stuff like Hellboy, and the kinds of material that you see people actually picking up and buying in a Borders or a Barnes & Noble. We need to have more of those choices out on the stands. And I think, you know, superhero comics are great. You know, we sell a shitload of them. And the, you know, if you look at DC's backlist, for instance, the stuff that sells over and over and over, in addition to the Vertigo stuff, but the stuff that sells over and over and over is, you know, Batman Year One and Dark Knight Returns and Superman for All Seasons and Batman Hush. They're all the stuff that people come back to again and again, or that the audience comes back to again and again, are finite, closed-ended stories that have a beginning, middle, and end, and that people can pick up and read and, you know, get a good story out of it from page one to page, you know, 212 or whatever the last page is. And I don't think we're doing enough of that. We're doing too many stories that look backward instead of forward. We do too many stories that want to depend upon the readers knowing 20 years of DC continuity.
I think the term is continuity porn.
Exactly. As a publisher, it's very easy to do that stuff because you know that there's an audience for it. You know that a certain audience is going to gobble that stuff up. And that's great, and there should be product for that audience. But, you know, if you just handed the layperson, Final Crisis, I mean, shit, people who have been reading comics for 20 years didn't understand it. So how do we expect anybody that hasn't been looking at comics for 20 years to even have a clue of the story that's being put in front of them? I think comics are a brilliant medium to tell stories, but we're telling too many of the same kinds of stories, and those stories form a barrier to the vast majority of the readership.
And I'm all for embracing history and stuff, but what I liked about your run was that you took all that history, you respected it, you didn't really alter anything in history, you didn't change anything or retcon anything like that, but you did make it very accessible, and obviously I was reeled in like a fish, but that it worked. Do you think this is going to get better, or do you think it's going to get worse?
I think, unfortunately, I have to think that for at least the near future, it's going to get worse because, you know, when the economy is crappy, perhaps you guys have noticed that the economy is in somewhat of a downturn. You know, when the economy goes in the tank, publishers, you know, go back to the tried and true, and the tried and true is appealing to, you know, is appealing to the audience that's out there. It's appealing to that those guys that you know are going to buy the damn books every week. So I think, unfortunately, in the short term, we're going to be, you know, just doing more of the same because that's how people are going to stay in business. I know just from anecdotal evidence, you know, stuff that's new and different is not getting ordered by the retailers. You know, I can even, you know, three, 4 or 5 years ago, you know, when Luke Ross and I did Samurai Heaven and Earth, right after we did our 6 issues that ended the current volume of Green Lantern, the Samurai stuff sold, you know, basically 25% of what the Green Lantern stuff sold. And for my money, the Samurai stuff was a lot better. But just because it was something different, it was not attached to a tried-and-true concept or character, you know, the retailers and the readers don't give it as much of a chance. You know, it's to my mind, the audience wants its comfort food. You know, it wants Big Macs and Whoppers. Yeah. And if you bring them something different than Big Macs and Whoppers, they generally don't want to try it. And again, it's little by little, hopefully this stuff is starting to change, and I think the internet will be, in a lot of ways, the great equalizer, because the internet is getting material in front of people who wouldn't ever set foot in a comic shop. I mean, that's why the big internet comic hits aren't superheroes.
Yeah.
Because the audience that's looking at them doesn't give a crap about superheroes. And hopefully there's a happy medium somewhere that we can have a bunch of different genre material, and each find its own audience.
I hope so. Well, that's all I got for you, Ron. It's been a pleasure. I'm gonna turn it back to Ryan.
All right. I got two last questions here from the boards, and we'll wrap up the podcast. This is from Muzard. If you could write one new Green Lantern story over any other idea, what would it be about, generally speaking, set in the GL universe as of this
month? Oh, you know, hell, I don't even have an answer to that for the most part, because it's not something that I spend any time thinking about. There was one story that we never got to do that I wanted to do. So that would, my only answer is this, that we had at one point pitched an Elseworlds with the entire Green Lantern cast. Oh, wow. as Camelot. And you know, the Green Lantern ring was essentially Excalibur. Gantt was the Lady in the Lake. Well, you know, they both wear a dress, so what do you want?
Original picture
with the ponytail, right, Rod?
Exactly. Or the reins, as we like to call it. You know, every character within the Green Lantern mythology was going to be represented in the Arthurian mythology. Alan Scott was Arthur, and Hal was Lancelot, and I think Kyle was Kay, maybe. No, he wasn't Kay. He was, I can't even remember the details. But, you know, anyway, it would have played out in much the same way as the Arthurian legends, but with the cast of the Green Lantern scenario that we're familiar with. So off the top of my head, that's the only one that I can think of that we never got around to, that still kind of is in the back of my mind.
Gamera asks, what do you think of the fact that Parallax was made into an entity that caused Hal to go crazy, and about Kyle no longer being Ion and Ion being another entity itself?
Well, these things are cyclical. Somebody that comes on the book after you builds on what you did in one way or another. And the fact that, that Jeff did Rebirth and found a way to bring Hal back, and it's been hugely successful, I think is good for everybody involved. Because like I said, we certainly didn't have a back door to bring Hal back when we did the storyline. That wasn't something that was ever even remotely discussed. So the fact that, that was the solution, and if that works for everybody, I'm cool with it. Everybody, that's one of Jeff's strengths, is that he can plug back into stories and continuity, but do it in such a way that it doesn't act as much of a barrier to new readers. Because I think, despite the fact that Rebirth was obviously, predicated upon stories from the past, I think that was a jumping on point for Green Lantern for a lot of people. Just like when Kyle took over, it was a ground floor point for readers. I think Rebirth is the same thing. And thank God for that kind of stuff, because it keeps the franchises fresh. It keeps them revitalized. Otherwise, if you just keep doing the same thing over and over and over, eventually the audience is bored and they're buying the books just out of habit rather than real desire to see what happens next. Rebirth has started a really good run on Green Lantern, so I'm fine with it.
And who knows, maybe in 10 years someone's going to retcon the symbiote bug entity anyways. I mean,
right.
These things happen.
Well, and if that happens, that's cool too. I just hope that if that happens, whoever does it in a way that it doesn't act as a barrier for readers. This is enough of a niche industry that we need every reader we can get. And we have to, we have to be rolling out the welcome mat, not the do not disturb sign.
All right. Well, that's all our questions, so we're going to wrap up the Green Lantern Spotlight podcast. Ron, thank you so much for coming on this cast. I know we had a lot of technical problems, but thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to come talk to all of us.
No problem, guys. When the Witchblade editor calls and wonders why his issue's not done, I'm just going to give him your number.
That'll be our future podcast. Editor is wanting to kill me and everybody attached.
I'll take it.
Crap, I knew I had to be on this episode.
And he says that from down under. All right.
That was a pleasure, guys. I'm happy to do it.
Oh, thanks, you, Ron.
Thanks
you
a lot,
very
Ron.
Much. Oh, actually, Andrew, I think he had a little something you wanted to tell Ron there really quick.
It's just fantastic to talk to you personally. I missed you at the Emerald City Con last year. Going to miss you this year. Hopefully next year, man.
Well, I'll be in Calgary, so you're going to have to get on a plane.
Oh, and one thing. I thought I might bring the possibility to you of possibly doing a future podcast with you and Daryl Banks.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. Daryl's I don't talk to Daryl anywhere near as much as I should these days, but, obviously, we were, joined at the hip for about 7 years.
Sometime maybe in the next couple months, 3 months, 4 months.
Yeah, drop me a line and let me know, because I'd be happy to do that.
All right. All right. Bye.
Well, we'll do that. All right. Well, I'd like to thank everybody and for the podcast here. Andrew for joining us. Wes, Kuhan from in Australia. Ray for helping us. And, of course, Ron Mars for joining us on the podcast. Look for us here at the cast, and we will talk to you then. All right.
Oh, this was probably the best podcast we've ever done. The guys and I had a great time talking with Ron. We're hoping to get him back here in a couple months here with Daryl Banks, and we'll have a kind of a Green Lantern reunion. We'll have that something coming up a little later this summer. In the meantime, guys, we will see you later here at the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. Good night.
Green Lantern and Green Lantern Corps are property of DC Comics and do not reflect the authenticity of this podcast.